Well, welcome everybody to a new episode of the Art Business Podcast. My name is David Bellingham. I'm the Programme Director of the Master's Degree in Art Business at Sotheby's Institute of Art in London. And my guest today, I think it's very apt that this is International Women's Day. I'd like to congratulate all women out there, you know, including my mother, rest in peace, who brought me into the world for better or worse, but all the women, all my sisters, three elder sisters, all the women I've ever known, and particularly my women students. And Sharon is a woman. So yes. Welcome, Sharon, and happy International Women's Day to you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And it's very fitting because I think we particularly celebrate the, if you like, the potential talent of women today. And Sharon is a highly talented, if I may say so, entrepreneur in the realms of technology, business and art, which is why she's agreed to come on the Art Business Podcast today. And the link, I guess, with what I do is that Sharon, in 2016, nearly 10 years ago now, time flies, Sharon studied with my esteemed colleague, Jeffrey Bollaton, who runs a semester certificate course in art and business, where I believe Sharon... Oh, anyway, welcome, Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a delight. And where I believe you study both the history of art, you have a little bit of history of art, and as well as business, because I think it's primarily intended for people who don't have any art historical background, but have quite a lot of business experience and don't perhaps want to go the whole way of the master's degree, but they want a shot in the arm, if you like, to understand the art world and the art business world. I know Jeffrey's course is really, really good. Sharon pursues research in data science, and she is currently working as the co-founder and director of a company called Alt Finance, which I will put a link to that in the literature accompanying the podcast. I think probably the most spectacular thing to date, other than Alt Finance, that Sharon has done, in my opinion, is actually establishing the Modern and Contemporary African Art Department at Sotheby's London in 2016 again.
Yes.
And selling over £5 million of African art during her tenure there, and breaking 25 world records for African artists. So congratulations again.
Thank you. Thank you.
So diving straight in, as usual, with the Desert Island Disc question, favorite city, Sharon, and reasons why?
That is a hard one. I'm someone who's lived in multiple cities in the last few years, from Ghana in Accra to Toronto to London, but also traveled to Dakar, was in Nantes in France. Love New York, been back and forth in New York where I currently live now. So it's hard to pick one, but if we judge by where I am currently, I would say New York is up there. Just for the access to a myriad of cultures and people from different backgrounds and arts and business and technology all in one place. But definitely have a love for different cities. Every time I travel to a new city, I tend to go to a museum. I love visiting museums in Lisbon. So definitely, it's hard to pick one, but yeah, I definitely someone who appreciates the variety of cultures and the arts.
I think that's a great answer because you're not pinning one city down, but you're basically talking about like an international, indeed global art world, yeah. Both northern and southern hemispheres, and you obviously know how to enjoy every city. And I believe your business is currently based in New York.
Yes, we're headquartered in New York.
Whereabouts?
So we're in the Midtown area, so on the west side, lower Midtown around Bryant Park. I'm up further up in Manhattan, so it's a really nice commute. Some of our team members are also in London, so we have a cross time zone, multi-time zone workflow. So yeah, between New York and London.
Fantastic, fantastic. And I know you come across to London, and I hope that we can meet next time you're across.
Definitely.
And then outside of cities, do you get out to the beach, to the mountains, to the countryside?
I love nature. I love to go visit and travel, like, go to a different hike and enjoy the outdoors. I can't say that there's very much of that in the city in Manhattan, but definitely there are some well taken care of parks and recreational areas. I must admit I haven't been out in nature as much as I would like to. But yes, when I get the chance, I do. When I was in London, I mean, London is a city where you have, more parks between cities, between buildings, and as you travel towards the west or the east side, there's a lot more space. So I miss that about London. But in New York, it's a bit more of a concrete jungle, as they call it. So not as much, but definitely miss the outdoors, miss trees and nature.
Yeah, I remember when I go to New York, if I have some free time, I always head northwards up to Central Park because I kind of miss the London parks. It's funny enough, actually, I asked some of my students in a seminar group the other day. We were talking about London v Paris as an art world centre and whether Paris is going to, you know, this is quite an argument, a discussion at the moment in the art market. Well, could Paris take over from London since Brexit? And I was saying, what do you like about London? And they say, oh, the part, the green space, which kind of surprised me in some ways, but it's quite right. And I wherever possible, if I've got time, I will get off the train like a stop early and walk across St. James's Park up to Sotheby's and Bond Street rather than going on the tube.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, you don't have to go very far to enjoy it. Hyde Park is right there. I used to actually, when I was at Sotheby's, I would, on my break, go to the park, enjoy the park, and then get back to work. So, you have just a lot more of that, spread out the city. Central Park is, we have Central Park here, but it's in a fixed, location right in the middle of Manhattan. So if you're not there, then it's not as easily accessible. But London just definitely has the advantage of, parks interspersed between buildings in different areas.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And of course, the other great thing about Central Park is that if you're into art, you combine it with visiting the Frick, which obviously is closed at the moment. I think about to reopen. Actually, while I remember, listeners will also probably have read in the news that I think Sotheby's, the auction house in New York, has now moved into the old Whitney, which yeah, and the well, which the Frick was at temporarily. Is that right? And then Frick will open again. And of course, you've got the Met Museum in the same space. And of course, the Guggenheim. We could just go on and on. And then the commercial art world, some of the posher, if I may say, gallery spaces are up in that region as well, a little bit like Mayfair in London.
There's the High Line, which I highly recommend.
Oh,
The High Line
yes.
is essentially a bridge that you can walk along, and it's around the
Yeah.
Chelsea area. And as you walk along the High Line, there are galleries that are interspersed in that area. So you can actually get off the bridge, go enjoy the galleries, come back up. And that High Line itself has, greenery and some art actually on the bridge itself. So definitely recommend that if you want to enjoy a mix of nature and art and the city all in one.
Oh, thank you for that recommendation. Yeah, and it's one of those. The High Line is something I always forget things in New York, and I think, oh, I can go to the Met, and then I suddenly think, oh God, there's the High Line. And as you say, every now and then you can come down off it, and go into, you're right above, I think, the Chelsea galleries a lot of the time, commercial galleries in particular. And of course, you've got the great art garden designer Pete Oudfeldt, who designed all the kind of greenery along the old railway track, which is the High Line. And Pete Oudfeldt designed the
Gorgeous.
garden in Houser and Worth, Somerset, which was one of the first big commercial galleries that moved out into nature.
That's amazing. And they also have some sculptures as well that have been installed there from different artists. So it's if you're not able to get down there, you can still enjoy some of the art along the bridge as well.
I think it's been added to all the time, isn't it? And as I understand it, I think they're about to copy that idea in Camden in London.
Oh,
And
really?
yeah, I think there's plans. People should look it up. There's plans to actually have an equivalent of the High Line running across Camden.
Interesting.
Yeah, there you go. And what about architecture? Is there any kind of particular building that you remember through your life walking into and just being moved by, or? finding incredibly interesting.
Architecture. I mean, it's funny you ask. My dad's an architect,
Oh, right. Yeah.
and so his career has really been a mix of arts and architecture. When I think of buildings recently, well, if you go in the city, if you go to 34th Street, there's a really huge building that actually has been closed because it's a bit of a hazard. If you go too far up, you can fall. But
Oh,
some people
goodness.
are not allowed to go up. There's really nice architecture at 34th Street. When I think of architecture, funny enough, I think of Richard Serra, and his sculptural works. The texture of the rust and the metal is something that has always I found completely really fascinating. Recently, a lot of the architecture I see, and it's of course skylines and huge buildings. When I think of creative artistic approaches to architecture and to texture of buildings, definitely Richard Serra is something that comes to mind.
Absolutely. And of course, Sarah, particularly in the Guggenheim Bilbao, I don't know if you've been there, but his works take up half of the museum, and it's literally like walking down these alleys of cort and steel metal, which he likes to use. It's incredible.
During the Sotheby's Institute program, we actually went to see a show at, I think it was at House of Worth. I went with one of my colleagues from the program, and we took pictures exploring the installations, and definitely was one of my favorite moments of the program.
We have a couple of Richard Serra drawings, amazingly, like geometric drawings signed by him, like limited edition on the walls of our office in London.
Amazing.
So
Amazing.
yeah, and thinking about New York, actually, it's on the skyline. I'm afraid I'm going to be boring, and I can't. I still love the Chrysler Building in particular, and its kind of architectural details. It's probably something you're just so used to, you probably don't notice anymore.
Well, I think one of the great things about New York is when you are in any particular area, you can actually get a mix of historical relevance in the buildings. So there's a place, part of the city that I like to go to. It's around 59th Street. And if you go on at the top of one of these hotels, and if you look around, just look around the 360 view, you can see newer buildings, older buildings, pre-war buildings, and they're all mixed together. And you get a taste of the history of the city through the buildings that is, across the neighborhood. I think that's one of the great things about the city as well, being able to appreciate the architecture and the history of the buildings as well.
No, definitely, definitely. And of course also interiors, and the most obvious one for me is Grand Central and Penn
Yes.
Stations. They're just really remarkable. I mean, if someone
Yes.
says what would you recommend I go to when I'm in New York, I say make sure you go into Grand Central
Yeah.
and the Oyster Bar,
Yeah.
which
Yeah.
is fantastic. What's lovely about the Oyster Bar is everyone goes on about it, but it's just so, if you sit at the bar, it's just so rough. It's not like a posh place, and you can eat the most amazing oysters, have banter with the kind of bar people, bar staff, and drink champagne, or in my case, non-alcoholic champagne. It's very nice. And I guess the romantic idea is it's before you traveled, you would go and do that. And what about music, Sharon? Do you have any, do you have eclectic taste like most of my guests, or
Yes, so music is a big one. I studied music in school, and I play instruments as well. I play the piano. I actually kind of got a new piano, so my
fantastic.
piano, and I play the saxophone. So definitely had a appreciation for the theoretical, side of music with composition. These days, I still listen to a lot of different things. So I'm right now into bossa nova, Afro samba, jazz,
Do you
classical.
mean just listening or dancing?
Well. well, yes, both and singing actually, all three of them together. Yes, I appreciate all three of them. And
And of course,
so
New York again is a great place for jazz. I think I was speaking about this on a former podcast as well. And anyone listening, if you want to actually see what I think of as kind of authentic New York, Greenwich Village is a good place to go, and just go into any of the jazz clubs. It's pretty expensive, and but people are very friendly there, and it's a great scene. And you can see traditional jazz, you can see really contemporary jazz, and so on. Do you actually perform? Do you play anywhere yourself?
You're the second person asking me this. I will. I actually plan to soon. I just want to get practicing a little bit more, and then I'll definitely, step out and start performing again.
Yeah.
But yes, definitely something in my plans. There are a lot of really good jazz clubs as well if you go up, so around the Harlem area. There's some
Yeah.
in Brooklyn as well. So you'll find some good ones in the neighborhoods that are not as frequently visited.
Yeah, as a tourist, of course, I go to the obvious sort of places, if you like. Well, you have to start somewhere anyway. And then the most difficult one is art. I mean, obviously, it's a stupid question to ask, my guess, but I often say, you know, if someone puts a gun to your head and say, right, you have to pick a work that you'd have on your desert island. Can you think of maybe an artist or maybe a work?
I have a few really favorite artists. Shuina Shat is an Iranian artist that I have been fascinated by. I love the calligraphy and her photography. Karime Weems, also another photographer. Micheline Thomas, a contemporary artist.
Yeah.
Those ones to mind. Sanford Biggers. I've been really interested in contemporary artists. Of course, modern contemporary African artists as well, with a lot of them who are actually friends, and some of who have actually acquired some of their works as well. So it's hard to pick a favorite. I think it depends on the themes or, you know, what mood I'm in or interested in. But definitely some really exciting works coming out, and that have also a lot of historical significance as well.
Yeah, it's a good answer because, you know, art is actually about, it's kind of a trick question, really, because I was hoping that I always hope people will answer like you've answered, because it really is like music about mood, you know. But it's great. It's obvious we'll talk about your work later, but it, you know, you are heavily involved, obviously, in the art world and make sure that you're out there kind of rising stars as well as established people. Shirin Neshat is actually one of my first loves. I remember there being a show in Amsterdam of her video art, and the mu it was all with music by Philip Glass, the minimalist American
Oh,
composer.
wow.
And
Wow.
the films were amazing. They were all about particularly women's life in Iran, and of course, because she can't go into Iran herself, because she's quite a critique of that, what she sees as a very more patriarchal system, if you like, than some. I think she has to make the films like in equivalent places like Morocco, North Africa, if I remember rightly. But they're incredibly, and listeners, if you know, listeners, I think will recognize her work, as you say, with a lot of calligraphy, a lot of self-portraiture in it as well.
It's absolutely breathtaking. I saw her work in Venice. I've seen it actually quite a few times in Lisbon and in Venice. In Venice, it was an installation, and it was several feet high. So actually, it was, you know, it was the high ceilings, and they had photographs along the wall. I think it was easily over 100 photographs, large scale, and it's just incredible. And just there was also a film installation as well, one of the rooms. I think she's an artist that is incredibly brave, and even in her style of work, very sometimes simplistic in the last lack of color, you know, black and white, but still really with the high contrast photography, it just really takes, like, you know, it's capturing. I speak out. I'm a fan.
You don't own one though, do you? I don't.
I
I'd
would
love
love to, not yet. I would love to. Yeah,
to.
when the opportunity arises.
Absolutely. Yeah. So after completing your Bachelor of Communications degree at Queen's University Kingston in Canada, you then appear to have moved to France to study marketing. I think probably at Audencia Business School in Nantes.
So it was a Bachelor of Commerce degree. So it
Oh,
was
sorry, commute. I thought COM. Of course it is. That's how naive I am.
So that's how it mixes together. So it was a student
Bachelor of
exchange
Commerce. Yeah.
program. As part of the commerce program.
Sure,
So
sure.
Queen's has a relationship with Audencia, and so I had an exchange during my
Oh, I
third year.
see. Yes, I
So yeah.
see. Yeah, because our MA business program, I think we've stopped it now. I don't know why, but we used to have, for many years, we had Audencia students coming from Nantes to study for a week. They'd study the art market with us in London for a week. And that's that. I went to Bilbao with the leader of the program, and that he was taking s his Nantes Audencia students to Bilbao to look at public, not-for-profit sector art institutions, and he invited me out there. And that's when I saw the Guggenheim Bilbao. Have you been to that one? All
I
these
have not
Guggenheims.
yet.
Yeah,
Not
yeah,
yet, to be
yeah.
honest.
And now I hear really good things about Abu Dhabi, the building in Abu Dhabi, the good
Yes.
thing.
Yeah.
So all of these places that we need to get to, really.
No, we need to tackle.
At some point you combined your academic background in commerce and marketing with art, because in 2016 we've already said you studied for the certificate program in art and business at Sotheby's Institute of Art, and that was in London. And in the same year, I mean, we're kind of repeating myself, but you joined the African Modern and Contemporary Department at Sotheby's London. Now, have I got that right? Or because I think you might have actually helped to establish that department.
So when I was the second person to join the department after our head of department, Hannah Leary. So it we built everything from the ground up. And if you imagine Sotheby's as a really old institution with its own, practices and business structures, there really was nothing. And we had to, create our own client lists, get work to be consigned for auction. Our own marketing material, standardizing the cataloging format, marketing partnerships. I brought in Morgan Stanley to sponsor one of our events, and just a lot of work on the ground to establish a space where we could present these works and also build the client relationships to, earn that trust and to be able to, participate in the market in a meaningful way. And it was a really exciting opportunity. Essentially, I mean, the reason why I got into Well, so I've always had a passion for art, and while I was studying business, I wanted to look at ways to work in the arts. My dad did not want me to work in the arts because, for obvious reasons. But I was always fascinated about how the market worked and how the business side of it functioned in terms of sales and the economical structures that held up the art world. And so over time, I'd worked in different places like Studio Museum in Harlem, Creative Time. And I was actually working on an art fair project in Accra when I started talking to Sotheby's. And so Sotheby's was really a part of that journey in terms of exploring ways in which we can look at the commercial side of the market. It may seem a little bit too commercial in terms of thinking of the art world. I know we like to think of the artwork, but essentially, I mean, it's an industry where there is a money side of it, and then there's the art side of it, and the money side of it funds the art side. And so understanding how these economical structures work has been a fascination of mine, and look, exploring that with technology has really been where I've been really, really passionate.
Yeah, I'm glad that you see the a symbiosis between art and money, because I guess that is the big point of our master's degree in art business is when I'm interviewing candidates, they quite often say, what would you say is the main theme of your program? And I say the relationship between cultural and financial value. And we believe we most art history departments will actually jettison the money altogether. And we think that's wrong. We believe that the two, as you seem to have suggested, are actually interrelated and always have been interrelated. So that's quite nice to know. And what I was going to add actually is that you probably know this, that in a couple of weeks they've got the April sale of the Modern Contemporary African Art at Sotheby's in Bond Street. And when we get back from the European Fine Art Fair in the Netherlands next week from a study trip, I'm taking a group of students, and we're going to be shown around by the current specialists. I don't know which one yet, but I don't know whether you still keep in contact with them.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there've been changes since then. The Contemporary African Art Department has been actually added into the Contemporary Department in general. So there's definitely been some restructuring. So if it is a contemporary still, then you would be meeting with the contemporary specialists, definitely. That would be taking it around.
No, that's interesting. I would also say that it is a wonderful opportunity to visit the preview of all these exhibitions, but particularly I think the modern and contemporary African art, because it's so difficult otherwise to see that amount of material from Africa anywhere else in London. There are other commercial galleries. Like I did a podcast with what used to be Signature Gallery, Davis Street in Mayfair, with Khalil, and as I understand it, he's I must look it up again, but he closed that gallery down, but I think he's opened another one, with and it's something to do with the England rugby union player who's an art collector. Just trying to remember, is that Otobi or something? Sorry, it's gone right out of my mind. The name sounds quite similar to yours. Atoji. Atoji. And amazingly, he's a kind of macho rugby player, but he's a great art collector, apparently. So, and one, another, actually, another of my guests, Dong Min, of a podcast, she's an MA Art Business alumna and a professional photographer. She photographs rugby, and she
Oh, wow.
told me the first time, oh, you should see if you could interview a Toji because he's a great art collector and he's my hero. I take photos.
Yes.
You know, she photographed, as it's International Women's Day, she also specializes in women's, like the England women's team as well, taking amazing photographs, action photographs of them.
That's
So
great.
there you go. And then in 2018, you set up your own e-commerce advisory company, R and Co. And that was followed in 2021 by another company, this time I think for software called Orbt, Orbt. And both of those were
Orbit.
based in New York. So can you tell us about those two companies, and did they have any links to the art world?
Yeah, so I mean, as I mentioned, my passions are really at the intersection of art, business, and technology. And Art Co Developers is really my work in research around building of websites and applications and software solutions, not necessarily directly tied to art, but a way for me to really explore how the world that world worked and how to, you know, look at different innovations around technology with software. So we did that for a few years, building solutions for e-commerce businesses, some of them in the arts and some of them with galleries. And during that time, you know, COVID happened and we're already researching around innovation around 3D technology to do visualization. So virtual galleries, virtual showing rooms, and using 3D software to create interactive multi-sensory experiences. We launched with an art fair in collaboration with Prism Art Fair, which is a satellite fair of Art Basel, Miami. And so created a digital art fair online that you would be able to go into different booths, which had pages and virtual showing rooms. And so that actually was very successful. And we did that for at least, I think, 18 months, focusing on building that out. And that's actually what brought me to New York from London. And really looked at ways in which we would commercialize that around the arts world with businesses like galleries, but also with creative products like fashion. And during that journey as well, we actually built a community with NFT artists. And so with the proliferation of, you know, Web3 and NFT artists, we created a space where NFT artists could have virtual galleries on the website. And so we launched a showcase that we presented with Ghanaian NFT artists, which was a contemporary Ghanaian NFT show using technology as well. And since then, you know, with the research that we've also been doing around technology and data, built Alt Finance. Alt Finance really just started because I had a client that was a wealth advisor at Coutts Bank, actually, and had asked me some questions about valuations of the banks he worked. And I thought, well, I mean, you're an established institution, you must have data. Where is the data? Why, how do you usually get insights on this? And it turned out that, you know, the most recent attempts to research the market was a 2019 PDF report on passion investing in general. I thought, well, I mean, the market has changed a lot since 2019. So, I mean, it sounds like they're far behind. And at the time, because I was already plugged into the technology ecosystem, came up a way to create some demos and some samples, solutions that would enable us to track the markets in an interactive, kind of like a live calculator experience of analyzing valuations of assets. And that's how, you know, we got to talking again in terms of, you know, using Alt Finance. But it's really been a journey of exploring and building solutions around business, technology, and the arts. And along that way, you know, I've had the opportunity to work with some really great, you know, investors and clients and businesses as well. And it's been an exciting journey so far.
Fantastic. And I just before we started this, I was watching a live watching online a live auction at Phillips of their Contemporary Art Day auction, and there was a Banksy, and I play a game, an art tactic game called Art Forecaster. I think we spoke about it, where Anders Pettersson, who's another guest on this podcast from earlier times, he and his team selects a few works from each auction, you know, important auctions, and we have league tables. And what you have to do is they give you the estimate, and they provide you with some data from past sales of that artist and what they sold for, and then you have to guess what the work's going to sell for. And one of them today was a Banksy, and because once you've submitted your answers before the auction, obviously, you can then see what everyone else has selected in percentage terms, and no one has selected bought in, and this work was bought in, which was good news because it means that no one actually got a point for that. So it's not gonna push me down at all. But that art forecaster, I think we were talking about it, it's a really good way of actually understanding that understanding valuation in the art market is a mixture of skill and luck. And what I was going to ask you, Sharon, with the you know, because we've actually subscribed to Art Finance with our students this year. And what I was going to ask you is that, you know, for example, do you reckon that you could use Art Finance as a tool when you're actually doing a bit of research on these, you know, what the work is likely to come in for?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you mentioned the work was bought in. There are several reasons why it would be bought in. It, you know, doesn't necessarily mean there was enough demand. It could mean that the estimates were too high. It could mean a variety of things. And so being able to have the data to look at comparable works and analyze, you know, Banksy's works in general would provide some general context into, okay, maybe this these estimates were higher than usual, or maybe the demand has gone down. The different ways in which you could actually analyze it, just like you would look at, you know, any kind of assets that trade on the markets, having the kind of data that's required to get a full, you know, 360 viewpoint, and also the filters required to actually drill down your viewpoints. So, for example, with Alt Finance, with the dashboard analyzed by artists, for example, you could then look at Banksy's works. You could then filter by the, you know, the format. Is it a photograph? Is it a work on paper? Is it a painting? Is it a recent work? And having all those data points help you to analyze it with much more in-depth, you know, analysis. And that's really what we're here to solve. You know, for a long time, people say, you know, the art world is very, a lot of things that I hear, art is illiquid, or I hear art is hard to understand, or the market is very opaque. These are all words that are used because the data is not as easily accessible, and that's what we're here to change.
Sure. I mean, I often say to my students, imagine what it was like when I was your age, where you know, it's literally you'd have to know people in the art world who were maybe gone over to a sale in Hong Kong, because this data just wasn't available unless someone then phoned you up or you know, even before emails, like phoned you or wrote you a letter or sent you a telegram and said, oh, the bank, you know, the Warhol failed to sell, and then you'd see the work appearing maybe in a London sale later, and no one would know that it had failed to sell. And now, of course, we have all this data at our fingertips. What I would say is, because some listeners might be saying, oh, well, Alt Finance, your platform, you know, what did how does it differ from other platforms like ArtNet? And what I would say is that it enables some of those other some of those other platforms like Art Price and so on are slightly patronizing that they don't let the user do that much. And yours is very, very flexible. As you say, you can apply all these filters and really drill down into. So, you know, if I were looking at Banksy, I would be looking also at Phillips as, you know, what how does Phillips usually do? Because the actual auction house, I think, has an effect here as well. So I think what your tool, what Alt Finance as a tool allows you to do, it seems to me, is, you know, it's using similar data to those other platforms, i.e. auction prices, but it's enabling you the analytical tools, I would say, are much more user-friendly.
Definitely appreciate it. Yeah, exactly. So, for example, with the Banksy, so we could take different views. So let's say we had a theory and say, okay, well, maybe this work didn't sell because it was sold in, I guess, London, or maybe it's better more like to sell in New York, or maybe the market is elsewhere. We could actually filter by region and also look at where, you know, the sell-through rates. And it allows you to question and to have hypotheses and to actually see the data and what the data says, and then, you know, validate that, see whether that's right or wrong. So if you are, you know, bidding in a sale, or you're playing the game with forecasting, or, you know, you're just researching in general, being able to then, you know, drill down those filters, get the visualizations, whether it's a pie chart of the sell-through rates, or, you know, a bar graph with the listings of the, you know, the sales in total with the value, or maybe a box plot that shows you the range of estimates. Maybe we say, well, typically Phillips might place their estimates a bit lower or higher. All these different viewpoints help you to then better understand what you're looking at.
And I would say to listeners as well, it doesn't guarantee, you know, that, you know, like any other assets, what thinking about, you know, are these assets going to go up or down in the next few weeks? It could be gold, it could be oil. The same with art, and in fact, almost more so with art, you know, because a work of art is a hedonic product, and so each work of art is unique, and there's so many different factors. So, you know, you also, not only would you use Sharon's art finance data, but you should also be looking at the catalogue notes, at the provenance history. All of these things can affect whether the thing's going to do well or bomb, which is exactly what happened to the Banksy today. Which was actually an elephant with a bomb on its back, by the way. I think it's called something like heavy weaponry. That's right. I'm looking at it now. heavy weaponry. But you know, it's no guarantee of, and Sharon would be the last person to say this would guarantee you success. What I would say, and I've said this to my students, when I haven't got much time to do this, I just use my knowledge, my experience and knowledge and instinct to choose. And I've experimented with this, and I'm more successful when I actually look at data and rationalize. Yeah. And also the other point about that is that if you have looked at the data and rationalized the price, and then it's nowhere near it, at least you know that you've done your, you know, that you've understood it. You've understood what's going on, and you realize it must be something that I'm unaware of, you know, and so on. So I think it's just kind of almost like the exercise of doing all this kind of analysis, which makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, and I think if we think of it in just terms of like pure economics, you know, supply and demand meets, right? So based on the pricing, you have more people that demand or a few people that demand, and an item being bought in is really a reflection of the supply and demand at that price point, right? And the secret is, and maybe I should or should not tell you this, but there's also a lot of politics that goes into estimates, right?
Yes.
So it's not a hard and fast science. It's also business and business relations. And so an estimate might be higher or lower because, you know, that client that was consigning the work was also showing to another auction house, or maybe there was a lot of competition to try and get it up. And so just looking at that, you also have to understand that those estimates are subjective and also are subject to the politics. But the data doesn't lie. And so if an item is bought or it performs higher or lower than a lower high estimate, that those data points are really important to analyze and to understand. And it's all part of a trend. So you're right. I think it's good to look at the data, and it helps to contextualize it. So maybe if an item has been bought in, maybe have similar works by the artist has been bought in at that price point. Is it a work that's been listed before? There are all these other ways in which you can drill down to understand what's really happened in the auction room.
And I think it's all, if you have time, it's always worth doing like a post-mortem, you know, after the sale, and working out where you might have gone wrong and the reasons for that. What I would say is that, I'm sure Anders wouldn't mind me saying this, I emailed Anders after a sale of contemporary work a couple of weeks ago, because it was these emerging artists that tend to have quite reasonable estimates, but they're going way over the top of the range, you know. And I really kind of, you know, went wild and sort of thought most of these are going to sell for a lot more. I got zero. Wow. I couldn't get any of them right. And they were all selling at the low estimate or being bought in, which means not selling. And I reached out to Anders and said, I'm really embarrassed because I think you know who I am by my pseudonym. And he said, oh, don't worry, I did the same. So Anders Pettersson, I'm not claiming anything for myself other than, you know, teaching for many years, but he's a real expert, so I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying. And I think he told the students that David and I bond, but then like today I got like 7 out of 9 or something, you know. So I was probably a bit more thought, you know, so you learn from that. And of course, what was going on there, it was probably something to do with financial confidence. We forget that these people are probably, you know, they may just have money to throw off the top of a building, but a lot of them are actually having to be very careful with what they spend their money on.
Exactly. And our big vision is really contextualizing these insights. So for example, when we looked at, you know, hours or different asset types, we contextualize it against the S&P 500, the currency exchange rates, how the stock market is going. So really, I think one of the key differentiators with us as well is that we are looking in a way that helps you to get a real in-depth, you know, view of the market, not just with the particular artist, but how that artist and their works fit within the global economy. So you can also understand and see the patterns. So for example, we looked at some works that sold in an annual sale. We did a year-on-year analysis comparison, and we saw that actually there was a general 50% drop with the same sale. Well, that might be a bit alarming, but it could also be an opportunity to understand how to bid. And when you actually contextualize that with the S&P 500, we saw that actually it was part of a cycle with the economy. So definitely, I think these kinds of insights help. And remembering as well, like you said, that the people bidding in their room are also likely people that work in business or people that are investing their income in more conservative or more adventurous ways. It also helps to make sure that we are removing the subjectivity out of the data and understanding it from a more objective viewpoint.
Yeah, and of course, when we all, anyone who hasn't been, any listener who's never been to an auction, you must, it's not quite enough to watch online, although that works very well. And you begin to understand the auctioneer's behavior. You know, you almost get a sense that the auctioneer has been told by the specialist department, you know, we haven't had any interest in this, so we don't. You can almost tell that they've been given that information, I think. Or yeah. When they're hesitate, I shouldn't be giving all this away, should I? But when they're hesitating, it's because probably one of the specialists has told them, oh, we think that someone is willing to spend.
Yes.
And there's all that insider stuff going on as well, you know. And I always joke with Anders and say, I'm sure that the kind of A-listers that are kind of at the top of the art forecaster league, I bet they work in auction houses and they just know something's going to be eye.
Yes. I still go to watch auctions, and I can tell when something is going wrong and when something's going right. Yeah. And it's, I don't know if it's because just knowing the signals and being familiar, you can tell when, you know, this is something's a huge disappointment.
Yeah.
When it's exceeding expectations.
Yeah.
Definitely, you're right. It's a fascinating thing to watch and to be part of. You feel the anxiety in the room, you feel the excitement in the room. It's like mysterious, but also you can actually read between the lines. It's really fascinating.
And in terms of the technology, I noticed that, you know, at the start of COVID, I think they did start this beforehand that you could watch the live auctions, but it tended to just be a single camera on the auctioneer. And now, mm-hmm. you know, particularly, no, actually all of Sotheby's does it as well. They have multiple cameras. So you, mm-hmm. and I think that they have to be, I think that they can't show clients' faces, obviously.
Yes.
For confidentiality yep. reasons, but they do show people working there on the phone and so on. And you,
yeah.
you know, I would say to listeners to learn about how this art market works, the more of those you watch and the more kind of you understand the body language, if you like, including the auctioneer and the vocals, the more yeah. you understand it's part of this huge jigsaw that you really need to understand to really understand the art world. And it's very hard to teach that. You know, I can talk about these signs to watch out for to students, but it's up to them to go. And actually, and what I was going to say is last night I noticed Christie's in London in their big contemporary, modern contemporary, and then they had a surrealist sale. They'd arranged the room like a bullring. So the people sitting in the room, the clients, were in, it just looked like an arena, like with walls, and the people on the specialists on the phones doing phone bidding, they were up above like the audience, and the clients were all down. And I'm sure there was a psychology in creating like
definitely.
A bullring.
Definitely.
And
it's
then,
fine. Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, that we forget is that when it actually comes to it, there's a lot of adrenaline, as you say, flowing with the people who are bidding, and they can become totally irrational in what they spend.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And spend far more than they wanted to, you know.
Yes. It's the competition. You don't want to lose. And if you want the work, I mean, I was bidding on the work that sold for over a million. It was one of the world records for Ben Amou. And mm-hmm. talking to the client, and you know, the client says, you know, the client will say what they want to bid. And they want to win that work. And it becomes a thing of an ego thing. Okay, we've bid now. Okay, the client, the other person wants this. Do you want to bid? Okay, do you want to bid? And then you just keep going, and it's who has the biggest ego and the biggest bank accounts?
And you actually see people hiding, the specialists are hiding their mouths like yeah. footballers do, so you can't yeah. see what their tactics yeah. are. It's good hilarious fun. And, well, very, just very interesting. I heard a story, and I don't know how true this is, and I can't quite remember what the outcome was, But I heard a story in the early millennium that when people, Middle Eastern people, were building up their museums, like the Qatar museums and so on, with endless money, and there were two different sort of Emirate nations, I think, who'd just been basically told, "I just want that work." So there's two people basically having to keep bidding higher and higher because both of their clients have told them there's no end. And I don't know how true that story was, but I can imagine that could well be true, you know? When are you going to stop bidding?
It's a dangerous game because at the end, if it goes, you know, really high beyond a point that you didn't expect to spend and you win it, okay, you won the competition, but now you're paying a lot more than you
We have really the phrase easy. Buyer's regret, don't we?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we've all done it, haven't we? We've bought things at face value because we've been in the store and it's very seductive. And you, the next day you think, oh, I wonder if they take it back. I've spent too much money. We've all been there.
Yeah.
And Sharon, we could carry on talking about the auction psychology for ages. But I guess the point I'm making, and I think you'll agree with me, is however much data you use, I think the interesting thing is you understand what's going on more, but you still is still no guarantee that you're gonna. If it was, obviously we'd be billionaires if we knew it was going to be right every time. So what I was going to ask you next is, and you may be a bit embarrassed by this, but could you tell us about you've won some very high awards in your career to date? Could you tell us about some of the awards you've won?
Okay, so
or maybe just one if you're too embarrassed.
So recently there was the 100 women female investor and 100 female founder initiative that was presented by NatWest and Coutts Bank, and so they picked female business people in the UK, and so I was in the top 10 of that list, which meant that I got the opportunity to develop really close relationships with people at Coutts and NatWest. Which is actually how All Finance was born. And so we've had that recently. And we've also been part of different accelerated programs where we've been awarded funding. And we just got out of Techstars New York. And actually there's another one where we just got into, which hasn't been announced yet. But it will actually gives us the opportunity to work with different financial institutions in the US. So banks and insurance companies that will be using our product as well. And so, yeah, definitely been lucky to have some of these opportunities. We did our launch at TechCrunch Disrupt in San Francisco in September last year. And so we were awarded recognition there on the FinTech stage as well. Mm-hmm. So it's cool to know that we're building something that, you know, people want, that the market is excited about, and that we're getting new opportunities to continue to expand our impact with what we're building.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, well, the listeners have just heard Sharon talking about you know, she's working side by side with institutions like banks and insurance companies, and the reason that you're working with insurance companies is because they have to appraise works of art and their financial value for insurance purposes. And that's something that's traditionally, I believe, done by the big auction houses. But I guess that's quite interesting that they're reaching out to you to use your tools.
Maybe
make their own, you know, decision.
Yeah. Because usually when you get an item insured, it'll be based off of, you know, a one-time appraisal report that you might submit, but the market changes so much.
Sure.
And with the impact of, you know, just climate change, the insurance markets become a lot more volatile and just hard to, you know, be profitable in. So insurance companies have a lot of pressure now to make sure that they're staying on top of the market and they really understand what they're insuring, and they're developing products that are well, you know, packaged and priced. And so having the real-time, you know, access to insights on the market is really helpful for just being a much more efficient as companies that operate in this space. And so that's really where we're seeing a lot of demand around, you know, being able to access the data, model it, forecast, just as you would with anything else, you know, with cars, with homes, just have the data to actually do some real work with, is what we're seeing.
Yeah. And I think also you're willing to tailor your platform for different organizations. So obviously we're an educational organization, and Sharon has created our own dashboard for myself and my students, knowing what our needs are, as it were. The kind of analysis that the students will be doing for some of their assignments, and particularly often for dissertations, if they're analysing the market for a certain artist or a group of artists and so on. So Sharon I think Alt Finance will always listen and help you to tailor the platforms. And I assume that the platforms that you're tailoring for, like an insurance company, might look slightly different, you know?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So it'll be more about the policies and the insured assets, and you're able to pull in different data points that are relevant and plot that out, as required. So it's fun. It's fun to have the data and be able to do some really interesting and customized solutions, for different clients.
Yeah, and I bet it just as a kind of what's the word, get out clause for me, I've guests of this podcast have been from many of for some of those other platforms, including like Sebastian Duthie from and Veronica from Art Market Research, and that their specialism is really, and I know that they work together with similar organisations in the particularly in the UK rather than in New York and the US, and that they. Their specialism really is in creating like sector indices, and their data goes back to the 1980s. They've been around a long time. It's Sebastian's dad, Robin Duthie, was one of the first actually to write a book about art as an investment. So, there's lots of other platforms out there, but I think they all have their specialisms, which, and as I say, what really impressed me about Alt Finance, Sharon's, is the flexibility of it and the ability for the user to understand, that they can do their own analyses very, very easily, And I think you've also won awards for yourself, like 30, was it 30 under 30, the Telegraph, like a Forbes award, Telegraph award, I
So
think.
that's Apollo. I tend to like put them in background. Apollo magazine, there was a for top 40 under 40 art and tech, and
That's right.
then the Telegraph and NatWest, which was top 10 in the UK.
Fantastic. Yeah. Apollo, of course, the art magazine. Yeah. A good one, by the way, for people who are interested in, they tend to sort of feature interviews with collectors, art collectors. I don't know if they're still doing that. I haven't looked at Apollo for a bit. Let's get a copy. And then what I was going to ask you, well, we've already talked about the added value that your platform and services offer, like banking and insurance institutions. Do you also have art collectors, as obviously it's confidential, you can't name any names, but do you also have interest from big art collectors?
And it's a really powerful tool for art collectors because you're able to understand the artists or the markets before you acquire works or before you decide to sell them. Let's say you go to a gallery or an auction house to list something for sale and you get an estimate. You can actually check and see if that makes sense. And so some of our users are collectors. Some of our investors are also collectors. So there's really a nice connection with the art business market and what we've built. So definitely it's collectors and it's people in wealth management. And because the platform is so flexible, like we've discussed, you're able to actually use it for a variety of different use cases, which makes it very versatile.
And I guess you have to warn them what we've been talking about, that there is this, I think Anders calls it the X factor, that there's an X factor that adds to the financial value, which can't be valued, just the sheer enjoyment of the work of art in your house or on your wall, in your garden, which you can't really put a price on, but it's part of what makes studying like the art market so interesting. Can you tell us about a day in the life of working in Alt Finance? I mean, like a typical day, from getting up and getting into work, what kind of activities are you involved in a day?
It varies. For me especially varies. With our data scientists, it's a lot of, running queries. We have our databases where we've stored the data, and so we're running different scripts to gather and clean, structure, and train the data. We have AI models that we've been building. So a lot of it is technical. I know art is creative and it's art, but actually the back end of it is highly technical around the data side of it.
Sure.
Cleaning and all that. For me especially, because my role is quite far-reaching in terms of managing the company, a lot of what I do is pitching, presenting to different partners. Yesterday I had some business meetings. Today I have some more. We're working on a new partnership. So it actually quite varies from like strategy with the technology, bringing in new clients, bringing in new team members. We have some new team members coming in actually, which are specialized in business intelligence. So we're super excited about that. So it can be quite it can be it can range, but definitely some long days because you have to put in the work, but also some fun moments where we get to enjoy and celebrate in what we've been able to achieve so far.
Brilliant. And how much of this, what kind of percentage would you say is done online, and what, you know, how much of it is done maybe having coffee with a client, with a potential client, or having lunch or dinner with them? Do you do both of those things?
It depends. Lately, it's been a lot of meetings in person. And then we have quiet moments where we focus and we're head down. Top of the year was mostly quiet. This month, especially in the last 30 days, there's been a lot of meetings in person. And also depends on where people are and what the cycle is. So now people are coming out again, having meetings again in the city. So of course, get to take advantage of that. And then around, the quieter periods of the year, we tend to be focused on making sure that we're closing up what we've been working on. So it tends to vary as well.
Sure. And you've already said something about taking on some new business tech people. Can I ask you how many you employ, or do you outsource work, or do you actually have some full-time employees?
So our team is actually expanding at the moment, which is exciting. We are a team of five internally that work on the building of the infrastructure, but we've actually just signed a new partnership with AWS. So AWS have also a dedicated team that are working with us. That I cannot say the size of their team, but probably around another 10 or so. And then we have advisors as well that we work with that are specialists in the market. So we have about maybe six advisors as well. So altogether, we're probably an army of 25 altogether, all playing different roles on the team. And then we tend to, delegate as required.
And are your clients, I mean, this may be confidential, but, and you don't have to answer it, but would you say your clients are mainly North American, or are they from all over the world? And if they're from all over the world, are they like Chinese clients potentially?
So right now, I would say most of our clients and our market activity is in the US, within the Eastern and West Coast regions. But we also have clients like yourself who are in London.
An education.
Make up a sizable amount as well. We're working on some new partnerships actually to extend and establish presence in the Asia Pacific region. So that should probably come to life probably in the early part of the summer. So towards that end, we will start to publicize that as well. But for the past, 6 to 12 months, we've been focused on North American region and Europe together.
Sure. And just going back to where you were saying part of your job is pitching the platform to people. I remember we had a meeting with my director, Dr. Jonathan Wilson, and I think he follows you now on LinkedIn. And so he was very impressed by your presentation, as was I. And we look forward to kind of continuing to work with you, obviously. And I guess the thing for the students is that, and this is true of our subscriptions to rival platforms, if you like, such as AMR and ArtNet and ArtPrice, that they become aware of those different platforms and then continue to use them, and hopefully will start paying you, when they have their own sort of art businesses when they graduate. I guess that's kind of the idea of what we're doing as well, to let students see what is available there. But also, it's just so useful for them when they're actually doing their academic analysis of the art market. So I was just going to finish by asking what are your plans maybe for the rest of 2024? I was also going to ask you, would you ever go to an art fair and have a stand and to sell your product, or have you done that already? And maybe can you, well, let's try that first. Do you get out there to art fairs? Do you need to do that to market yourself?
Towards the start, we've been focused on a few like technology-focused initiatives. So we've done TechCrunch, which was where we launched, and really looking around the innovation side of data science, and building those relationships. And towards the this for this rest of this year, it's going to be a combination of that. So the financial services industry events, and then also some arts events as well. Because we cover a variety of asset types, it ranges across art. It also includes classic cars, luxury products. We are looking at the market activity of these different types of assets. So we actually get the opportunity to show at different types of events. Once we publicize where we're going to be this year, I'll be able to share more of that. But most of this year has been really focused on planning ahead in terms of strategy and making sure that we are, lined up to execute on some of the key goals that we have set up. So this year will be a lot more of product releases, releasing new dashboard solutions, releasing new partnerships with financial institutions, and then also some more public displays at some art fairs. So once I confirm that, I should be able to share that soon.
Yeah, and something we didn't talk about actually is that you're not just analyzing art. Your platform will allow you to analyze other what we might call luxury products such as car, classic cars,
Yes.
wine, I think
Wine, whiskey, jewelry, handbags, watches.
That's right. And that, again, this is something that we always tell our students that although our focus is on fine art and to a certain extent design and decorative art, we basically our students go into like the fine wine market or the classic car market because we're very, very broad in our definition of what art is. And of course we also do an MA now in luxury business. And I will talk to Federico Carlotta, who's the director of that course, and is doing very well. The numbers are increasing all the time because it seems to me that her students might find your platform very useful as well, because of those kind of luxury products that they're looking at. I think the last question I wanted to ask you, Sharon, is can you see yourself selling up and setting up another company as a kind of entrepreneur?
I mean, I think for us entrepreneurs, it's a bug.
It's in
We
your
like
it's
to
in
build
your
and to grow. So definitely, I think in a few years, I can see that happening. Right now, I am buckled in
Yes.
with all finance, so I can't see anything changing
Sure.
anytime soon. And I fundamentally believe that we are building something that can be an underpinning, a structure that can help to, support a lot of solutions, financial solutions, whether it be, financing, insurance, credits, risk, and really be the Bloomberg of this industry. So I think it's gonna take a while. It's gonna take a few years, so we're not going anywhere. But yeah, definitely we look at the opportunities that as they come about, when the time is right.
So it sounds as though at last you've settled a bit more, as it were,
Yes,
into something
we're here for some time. Yeah, yeah.
which has quite obviously, and you're expanding your staff and your clientele. And so I just, maybe end by just wishing you the best of luck in the future, thanking you for being so willing to help with the problems and solutions of the platform that myself and the students have. And I think there's obviously a future to use this more and more, maybe get some feedback from the students and so on. So thank you very much for being a guest today on International Women's Day. That was just a coincidence. I didn't sort of,
Yeah,
select Sharon because it was International Women's Day. I suddenly realized it was in my diary, So that's a nice coincidence. And I'd like to wish everybody out there, particularly the women listeners, a happy International Women's Day, and looking forward to next year as well. So
yeah.
we're off to the European Fine Art Fair, the major world classic art fair in the Southern Netherlands, and then we're going to Amsterdam next week with the students. And then when I come back, I'll be recording another podcast. It's a secret what that's going to be. So thank you to all the listeners, and thank you again, Sharon.
Thanks for having me.